Hello and welcome to episode 49 of the Clacks Women for Independence podcast. Music this week from Mew, M-Y-W, available from YouTube. And I rather like the slightly mystical feel to it this week because it seems to me we're in the middle of a lot of moving parts. It's almost as if positions are being taken up for the fight that's about to come. We've got the disgraceful decision of BBC Scotland that they will decide whether the First Minister's briefing is of any interest to us or not and whether it's newsworthy or not. And if you are one of these people, as I'm sure we all know, who aren't online, who rely on the BBC for their news, also in the group that is most likely to be at risk from catching the virus, so really, really need clear, up-to-date information, not filtered through journalists, filtered through news editors, or filtered through Tory party donors or Labour party agitators. The BBC know that by definition there will be no BBC in an independent Scotland, but there will be a Scottish equivalent, and you'd think some of them might want jobs in it. We are often reminded that there are many decent people work at BBC Scotland, many of them who also support independence. It must be a very, very difficult place for them to work. Any expectations that we might have had that things are going to get better at the BBC, it's just not going to happen. And there's nothing in it for them either. For their continued existence, they need to be on the side of the British state. And if that means denying our old folk information that might keep them alive, well, that seems to be the choice they're making. On the other hand, we have another barnstorming speech from Michael Russell, who, as you know, he's my favourite, in Holyrood this week on the subject of the internal market bill. We also have a clip from Richard Murphy on why Scotland will need a new currency once we're independent. But first, I know she's very busy, but I think the First Minister might have been listening to our podcast last week. You'll remember that we were talking about Grant Shapps' ridiculous statement that four different systems was confusing. And here's what we had to say about it on Tuesday last week when our podcast was aired at 10 o'clock on Indie Live Radio.
How can you say it's confusing the messages you're getting from different governments because only really our government is giving out? Yeah.
All you need to know is what country do you live in? Okay, do that.
Yeah.
And then in the First Minister's broadcast on Wednesday, here's what she had to say about it.
I think we've all got to guard against creating confusion where actually there needn't be any because people are no daft. You know, and when it comes to differences, whether it's differences in international quarantine or the limits in houses between Scotland and other parts of the UK, that needn't be confusing because most people know which part of the UK they live in. You know, they know whether they live in Scotland or England. So they know to follow the rules that apply in their countries.
Definitely singing from the same songbook as the Clacks Wifies on this occasion, and it would be lovely to think that with everything she's got going on that the First Minister might sit down with a nice cup of coffee and listen to our podcast. She certainly deserves a break now and again, that's for sure. The other topic that's been of interest this week has been the internal market bill. You'll recall, I'm sure everybody in the country knows, everybody in Europe knows, this is the Westminster rogue state's attempt to blatantly breach international law, certainly the bits they don't like, on limited and specific areas. Well, that's an interesting new set of rules to play by, isn't it? I hope the Scottish lawyers are filing that one away for future use. And the other new legal term which the rogue state appears to have brought in is that treaties don't count if you sign them in a hurry. So if you are too busy or, let's face it, too lazy to read the detail and you wanted to force something through Parliament so that nobody got a chance to read it, well, apparently that's okay because it gives you a get-out clause. I'm sorry, Your Honour, I accidentally mowed down 20 pedestrians. I was in a hurry. all the devolved governments realise that this is a power grab and have been quite vocal in making that point. Mark Drakeford particularly was interesting because he's a Labour politician, but as always, our very own Mike Russell put it beautifully in his speech at Holyrood this week. Here it is.
And I call on Michael Russell.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. Presiding Officer, the UK Government's internal market bill that was published yesterday represents the biggest threat to devolution that Scotland has seen since this Parliament was reconvened in 1999 after 292 years of adjournment. That threat comes from a gang of hard right-wing anti-devolution Tory Brexiteers who said during the Brexit referendum, in which the people of Scotland voted overwhelmingly to remain in the EU, that they wanted to take back control. And now we know what they wanted to control. Us, our country of Scotland, and our right to make our own decisions and choose our own future. They're trying to do so by removing from the people of Scotland and this Parliament the powers which were given to it 23 years ago, this coming week, by an overwhelming vote of our fellow citizens. But that popular mandate, Presiding Officer, means that it is the duty of every member elected by Scotland to stop them. That is not just the view of this SNP government. Here is what the Welsh Labour government have said about this bill. The UK government plans to sacrifice the future of the Union by stealing powers from the devolved administrations. It is an attack on democracy and an affront to the people of Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland who have voted in favour of devolution on numerous occasions. Last month, this Parliament considered the original proposal set out in the UK government white paper on the internal market and voted by 92 votes to 31 to reject them. Now we know precisely what these proposals are in legislative terms and what they actually mean for businesses, for jobs, for the lives of the ordinary citizens of Scotland and for their Parliament. But this bill also had something added to it, which was not in the consultation, brief as that was. On Monday, it was merely a press rumour. But now we know that the UK ministers intend to unilaterally alter and override solemn and binding commitments in an international treaty agreed by the House of Commons only in January this year. And on Tuesday, we witnessed something I don't think anyone in this chamber would have thought possible. A UK Secretary of State standing at the Westminster dispatch box, calmly informing the House of Commons that the government intends with this bill to break international law. Presiding Officer, the rule of law is the cornerstone of a functioning democracy. Without it, a state is nothing but a collection of desperados, set on whatever aim they choose, without restraint, and no matter the consequences. Moreover, as the Lord Chief Justice of Northern Ireland, Sir Declan Morgan, pointed out yesterday, such actions also undermine the domestic legal scene. As he put it, where there is an indication that a state intends to break international law, it may have a domestic effect on the confidence that the public may have in the legal system generally. So Johnson's reckless actions are now aimed not just at us, but they will also trash the UK's already tarnished international standing, put at grave risk sustainable and beneficial trading and economic relationships with most of the world, and weaken the legal basis of all our lives. And all that whilst he and his irresponsible and reckless government are hurtling in the midst of a pandemic and the worst global recession in many generations towards a hard EU transition deadline of the 31st December, a deadline entirely of its own choosing, with only two bad options left, a disastrous no deal or an almost equally damaging low deal, and armed only with blockheaded arrogance, a false sense of exceptionalism, and this entirely unnecessary and deeply damaging bill, which will actually make every problem worse. For the UK government has not only signalled its intention to break international law, it is also signalling its intention to break domestic law, to break the devolution settlement, which was once described as the settled will of the Scottish people. Presiding Officer, let me now turn to the detail of the bill. There is much in it that repays study, if only to reveal how contemptuous the Tories are of this place and of the people we represent. At clauses 2 to 9, there are sweeping powers to compel Scotland to accept lower standards set elsewhere in the UK on animal welfare, food safety, environmental protections, and a host of other areas. These powers would radically undermine the ability of this Parliament to serve the people who elected it. At clause 46, powers are given to UK government ministers to design and impose replacements for EU spending programmes in devolved areas such as infrastructure, economic development, culture and sport, education and training, or possibly more general public spending in those areas. Bypassing democratically elected MSPs and ministers in Scotland, these jeopardise current Barnett funding levels and will inevitably lead to policy confusion. But worse, given the centralising ambitions of the UK government, no one should be surprised if in the future they divert money that should be under the control of this Parliament for Scotland's schools and Scotland's hospitals to pay for what appears to be their priority of Union Jack badged projects. They are already limbering up, as we saw on Twitter last night, to spend money taken from other Scottish budgets on their own pet projects in the very few Tory constituencies left in Scotland. At part four, the bill establishes a new unelected monitoring body called the Office of the Internal Market, which will have the power to pass judgment and devolve laws and invite businesses with deep pockets to challenge the democratic decisions of this Parliament. And clause 48 reserves state aid, which is indisputably and without any pretense to the contrary, a blatant power grab. As we also know, as a result of the decision sneaked out yesterday in the midst of this bill chaos, the state aid provisions will merely mirror those of the WTO, making a deal with the EU even more difficult and provide little or no scrutiny or rigour. Presiding officer, the UK government says the bill will guarantee companies can trade unhindered in every part of the UK. That is not what this is about. There is no threat to such trade and never has been. This government endorses the need for such trade and will always do so. What they want is something different. In order to deliver bad trade deals, which is all they can expect from their weakened state, they want private health companies to have a guaranteed right to trade unhindered in Scotland, weakening and undermining the Scottish NHS. They want private water companies to be given a guaranteed right to trade unhindered in Scotland, undermining standards and raising prices. And they want, once their hooks are in, to be able to alter anything we do with just a flourish of a UK minister's pen. Because although the bill says that there may be exclusions from the principles of non-discrimination, the explanatory notes to the bill say that the bill will provide the base Secretary of State with a power to alter these exclusions to retain flexibility for the internal market system in response to changes in market conditions. In other words, presiding officer, the UK government can alter whatever we do, whenever it likes, regardless of the views of the people of Scotland. That is the open door to the kind of creeping privatisation and rampant deregulation that we have already seen south of the border. Yet all the while, they behave as if our heads button up the back, insulting our intelligence with the claim that this is in fact a power surge. That is only true in the sense that power surges destroy everything they touch. In reality, it is nothing of the sort. Every one of the powers they trumpet is already devolved, already exercised, in the context of a coherent set of agreed EU laws and institutions that guarantee flexibility and local autonomy. Contrast that with the system this bill wishes to put in place, a system in which the UK government can unilaterally and arbitrarily impose its rules on Scotland, regardless of the wishes of this Parliament. In the face of widespread stakeholder concern at these proposals, UK ministers have resorted to the familiar tactic of ignoring or blatantly misrepresenting the facts. But facts are chills that won a ding, as Burns observed. Organisations, farming, business, public health, environmental and many others across Scotland and the UK are deeply concerned at these proposals. They are seen widely and correctly as incompatible with devolution, bad for businesses and the consumers, dangerous for the environment, and an impediment to necessary and effective devolved public health measures. And they threaten to undermine the good progress made on common frameworks, the preferred, proportionate, and agreed means of managing policy difference across the UK when EU rules no longer apply. Presiding officer, it's late in the day for sense to prevail in the Johnson government, but there's still just time if they commit now to that agreed process. For my part, I repeat the undertaking I made in the Parliament on the 18th of August that we will not diverge in any frameworks area, existing or new, whilst these are finalised, and urge the UK government to do the same. This bill is actually a shabby blueprint for a much weakened constitutional settlement that would leave Scotland defenceless. It is, as the First Minister said yesterday, an assault on devolution, the like of which we have not experienced since the Scottish Parliament was established. We cannot and we will not allow that to happen. The UK government have now asked this Parliament for legislative consent for this bill. But in addition to the damage it will do, reason enough to refuse consent, it surely cannot be right that we are expected to agree to something that is, in the admission of the proposers themselves, against international law. The Scottish Government will therefore bring to this chamber a motion to refuse consent. We will also publish a full rebuttal of the bill, which we will distribute nationally and internationally. And we will take whatever other steps are necessary to defend what we have and what we need to retain in order to build for the future. Presiding Officer, it will be no surprise to anyone that the Scottish Government remains of the firm belief that the people of Scotland have the right to choose their own future, and we are determined to make that happen. After the events of this week, that resolve is steadier than ever. That is why, before the end of this Parliament, we will set out the terms of a future referendum clearly and unambiguously to the people of Scotland in a draft bill. But even if you don't believe, even after all this, that our interests as a nation would be better served as a full, normal EU member state, no member of this Parliament, of any constitutional or political persuasion, will, I hope, consent to a bill that offends international law whilst also breaking and discarding the established constitutional settlement. If any member does vote for that, then what they are voting for is not just Tory illegality, it is, in fact, the end of devolution. That is what is at stake here. That is what we must all defend with every skill we have, with every ounce of determination we can summon, and with a steely resolve never, never to be defeated.
Now, you probably need some cheering up after that speech. So what I've got now is a clip from Richard Murphy. We featured Richard before on this podcast, and just as a reminder, he is a chartered accountant and a political economist. He has been described by The Guardian as an anti-poverty campaigner and tax expert. He's Professor of Practice in International Political Economy at City University London, and a director of Tax Research UK. And as well as all that, he's just very good at putting complicated ideas simply, and that's why I like listening to him. So I'm going to play you the clip, and if you want to watch him delivering this, the clip is saved in the Indie Life Radio YouTube channel. There's a playlist called Debt, Currency, Finance, and anything to do with debt, currency or finance, we save in there so that it's a hopefully a handy resource for people if you want to go and look at some different views on things. Here's Richard.
Hello, I'm Richard Murphy, and I want to discuss what is a sensitive issue in Scotland, which is, will Scotland need its own currency after independence? Now, everybody who followed the independence referendum debates in 2014 will know that this issue came up time and again. And in the end, Alex Salmond, who was then leading the SNP, decided to say that Scotland would use the pound after independence. I'll tell you, he got that wrong. I'll also tell you, because I have met Alex Salmond, that he thinks he got that wrong. And he did. Why did he get it wrong? Quite simply because unless Scotland had its own currency after independence, it would not be an independent country. If that's the goal, independence is the goal, and being an independent country is the goal, Scotland has to have its own currency. Let me explain. Unless Scotland broke free from the pound, it would have no control over its economic policy after independence. And that's for a very simple reason. Whoever controls the central bank of a country controls its interest rate policy. Whoever controls its interest rate policy also controls its ability to borrow. And whoever controls its central bank also controls its ability, which is now very important, to use quantitative easing to mitigate any form of borrowing and create money to fund spending without relying upon taxpayers. All of those issues are absolutely, critically, and essentially, necessarily, under the control of the government of an independent country if it wants to manage its own economy. But if, as those who propose that Scotland use the pound suggest, that policy is left to be determined by London, then Edinburgh, which would then be the capital of Scotland, would have no control over the economy of the country which it was supposed to be governing. It is as simple and straightforward as that. The Scottish government could not decide how much it wanted to spend. It could not decide if it wanted to borrow. It could not decide if it wanted to use quantitative easing, and it could not set interest rates for the best interests of the people of Scotland and its economy as a whole. So why be independent if you can't control the most fundamental and basic issues within the economy? I don't know. So Scotland has to have its own currency. I guess the follow-on question which people ask is then, well, could it have its own currency? And of course the answer is yes. Very large numbers of places have left the governance of the UK and successfully created their own currencies. You know, let's just look at the former Commonwealth states. How many of them use the pound? Well, effectively, almost none. That's the simple, straightforward fact. There are some British Crown dependencies and overseas territories that are linked to it, but that's about it, and they really don't count. Otherwise, every country that's left the control of the UK has created its own currency completely successfully. So is there any reason to think that Scotland couldn't do that? No, none whatsoever. And there are other precedents around Europe. For example, when Czechoslovakia split into two states, they each adopted their own currency. Was that a problem? No. How long did it take? About a month. So this is not an issue for which there is no precedent and no experience. It can be done. I'm not saying there wouldn't be issues to negotiate. I'm not saying that there wouldn't be issues to manage. Of course there would be. And there would have to be agreement, ideally, between the remaining UK and Scotland about how that process would be delivered. But is it desirable and is it essential to the achievement of a successful, independent Scotland? The answer is unambiguous. Yes, it's essential. And anybody who says otherwise clearly hasn't got the interests of Scottish independence at heart. Speaking as somebody who's not Scottish, somebody who doesn't live in Scotland, somebody who's looking at this as an outside observer, I simply cannot understand how there are people who think they want Scottish independence who don't get the point that Scotland must have its own currency. It makes no sense at all to put that platform forward as if it is a serious basis for progress in the independence debate. It isn't. And it's time they backed off and realised there's only one route in which Scotland can be independent, and that's by having a Scottish pound. I'm Richard Murphy. Thanks for watching. Please subscribe to this video series on YouTube if you're interested. Also look for us on Facebook. I am on Twitter, at Richard J. Murphy. And at the same time, look at my blog, Tax Research UK, where you can find much more on these themes. And I'll see you again soon.
One of the unexpected benefits of the COVID lockdown has been the universal adoption of Zoom and such technologies to carry out all sorts of activities that otherwise we would have been meeting face to face. And this week, a couple of the Clark's Wifeys took part in Leslie Riddick's book launch, which was done by Zoom. Leslie's new book is really the result of her PhD studies. It's called Huts, A Place Beyond, and it's based on looking at the differences between the hutting culture in Norway and the other Scandinavian nations, and why isn't there such a thing in Scotland? And one of the things that she found was that interwar generations in Scotland were really keen on hutting and cycling and camping and all sorts of things. Huts were built in Scotland, they just failed to survive. One of the very interesting things about the talk that she gave was some of the differences in attitude and where we are now compared to where other Scandinavian countries find themselves. And it's all tied up with our land laws and our attitudes, and would be quite complicated, I'm sure, to unpick, but it does sound as if it's something that would be very valuable for us to do. The event was co-hosted by Andy Whiteman, who of course is very well versed in these kind of issues. The book Huts, A Place Beyond It is available on Leslie's own website, but also all the usual Amazon, Waterstones, what have you. And obviously buy the book if you want to know all about it. But I'm just going to play a couple of points from Leslie's talk on the book launch, which I thought were really interesting. The first is very topical, to do with what we call these days dirty camping. Perhaps a different way of looking at it, as Andy and Leslie tease out.
And what actually struck me just this week, certainly over the summer, but just this week, we had a debate in Parliament on Wednesday called Dirty Camping. And this was reflecting some MSPs' concerns about certain visitors to the countryside who had been behaving irresponsibly, leaving litter, and all the rest of it. And what I was fascinated about was that, you know, reading your account of Linoia, I think if I pronounce it correctly, that some of the same opprobrium was directed against the working classes of Oslo, who were attempting, perhaps for the first time, to go out to the countryside and enjoy themselves. Can you just tell us a little bit about that, and whether you think, in fact, there are parallels with what we've been seeing this summer and what has happened historically in Norway?
Hutters in Norway are completely secure. They own their huts. They're going to be handed down for generations. No one's going to push them around. No one's going to evict them. So it didn't start that way. These guys on this particular island, Linoia, they actually began their hutting exploits in 1922, exactly the same year as Carbeth, 1,000 miles to the west above Glasgow. And the hutters in Linoia, they were working class people who used rowing boats to sail across to the island. They first of all camped. And there was uproar from the middle-class burghers who were going past that island on the way to their own posher second homes on the peninsula of Nesodden opposite. There was uproar, particularly because of, it was dirty camping, because there's no water. There was one well, which was owned by the private houses that lived there, but there was no water in Linoia. There was no toilets. And so basically, stuff was happening in the woods, which was pretty apparent to anybody who was sailing past. So there was massive opposition to Linoia. The thing that's so fascinating is that the government, which owned the island, decided that the solution was not to go around evicting people, because there was an annual habit of people arriving from Easter and then coming every weekend. Instead, they decided to just provide facilities, huts, in other words. Well, not huts, hut sites, so that the families who had been regularly turning up to camp could basically make a better go of it. And they made requirements that there had to be arrangements for toilets. So effectively, they kind of spruced up the whole thing from camping to hutting. And that then became the story of these islands.
There are also some astonishing differences between us and the Scandinavian countries, which Leslie explained here.
There are 1 in 10, 1 in 12 Norwegian families own a hut. The same is roughly true in Sweden, Finland, Denmark. You can then look across at Canada, America. In fact, I'll save you time. Wooded latitudes, here's a shocker, have wooden huts. Because why wouldn't you? It's the perk of living at a wooded latitude. And Scots live at a wooded latitude. But whilst the Nordics have, let's say, roughly 1 in 15 families owns a wooden hut, in Scotland, that figure is 1 in 8,045. So that's how completely off beam we are. Put it another way, we've got 500 huts. The Norwegians have 500,000 huts.
And as ever, Leslie has some very clear thoughts on why this is the case and what's to be done about it.
The reason that the huge growth in hutting that's happened all over the rest of the Northern Hemisphere has not happened in Scotland is not because of these kind of small wartime hutting sites, although most of them have been evicted, turned into caravan sites, gentrified, and otherwise got rid of. It's because the huge growth in every other country was not in more sites like this. It was individual huts sited in beautiful locations, where you want them to be, in woodland, not in serried ranks like bucklands beside one another, which is what the whole British people have actually been made to settle for. And I don't mean that lightly. The idea of camps was actually built into legislation in 1939 to cope with the Holidays with Pay Act and the idea that the unwashed would basically start swarming around middle-class holiday resorts. At that point, there was going to be permission for councils to be able to fund camps to put people in. And of course, Butlins came to the rescue, opened his camp, and the rest was history. We got camps, not camping, and we got some small hutting sites, not the ability to have that hut away out somewhere, which is what the huge growth in hutting has been everywhere else. And that's what meant that hutting has just remained looking like an insecure, dodgy, stressful, working class thing to do. And there's nothing wrong with all of those things, but the middle classes want more than that for their holidays. They want to have something beautiful, and they get it now by renting something for a week that belongs to someone else, and that's as good as anybody expects they're going to get. So that's where we've got to. The final thing to say is that procedure means that the kind of holiday homes we have in Scotland are almost the wrong leaves on the line. They're not huts. They're proper houses that should be occupied by a local person. But because it's not possible to get land to put anything on, you're not going to pay the amount of money that it takes to get land in this country and put a humble hut on it, because you just wouldn't be able to finance it. And you wouldn't get it because the land is unavailable in the first place. So all of those barriers are sitting between us and the kind of easy, lovely, sociable, restorative, reconnecting with nature that everybody else gets at our latitude. And at the same time, what is the second home in Scotland is usurping rural Scots from the homes that they, the existing housing stock, that they ought to be able to access. So for all those reasons, I would love to see a hutting revolution in Scotland. But by gum, that's what it would take, because we would need to have different forests, different woodlands. They would have to be not cellulose factories. They would have to be open and available. But again, we have no idea how weird our forestry is. And huts sit in forests. So the fact that they're generally locked up at the end of play every day means you can't have huts in them. All of these things would have to change for us to have the everyday experience that everyone else has at a wooded latitude like ours.
The last time that I was in Glasgow, back in March before lockdown, was with fellow wifey Lynn, and we were through at Indie Live Radio having a discussion on the live show about the Yes Slates project, which Lynn has been involved with since the very beginning. As you might have heard last week's podcast, Clack's Wifeys are trying to get our monthly planning meetings up and running. We've managed to carry on the kind of sociable coffee chats, which is, of course, what we've been bringing you most weeks for our podcast and the virtual coffee shop section. But now that things seem to be hotting up a bit and we've got the First Minister talking about a bill for a referendum and what have you, we want to try and get back to being active again, but it is always challenging under the current situation. So we're looking around for ideas to see what other people are doing that we might be able to do as well. That was why last weekend we had our Bridges for Indie session. We're certainly going to do another one of those perhaps same time next month, because you can distance with those, it's not a problem. Hopefully also involving Yes Clacks this time, where we could perhaps do the first shift and they can come in and do the next shift, with some kind of indie changing of the guard in the middle of the bridge. Or maybe it'll be more like one of those exchange of prisoners that they used to do in the Cold War. And we're also considering doing a live link-up with the James E. Show on Indie Live Radio, if that's technically possible. One of the other things we're looking at is perhaps doing a wifey litter pick. because we thought, well, that's something that is of benefit to the community. Nobody's going to complain about you doing a litter pick. But equally, it's an opportunity to be seen, to get out there, a few flags flying perhaps, maybe answer some questions or have a chat if anybody's around. The other thing that we plan for this weekend is to have a pop-up exhibition of the Yes Slates, which are, say, beautiful works of art. And they, collectively, they weigh about 10 stones. So what we did yesterday as a dry run to see how long it takes to set them up as much as anything else, Lynn and I had to go at putting them out on display shelving that's been custom made for them. So we had to go at putting them out to see how long it was going to take in preparation for if we managed to do our door pop-up exhibition. But it very much depends on the weather, and the weather forecast is horrible. So we just took the opportunity on Friday when there was bursts of sunshine to set them up to have a look at. And I also wanted to have a go at doing a live stream to our Facebook page, which was the first time we'd tried that. So that worked quite well, although the picture quality wasn't quite what I would have liked. And we also filmed ourselves setting the slates out. So what I did this weekend was speed up that film and put it to a little bit of almost Benny Hill type music, although we did do a Scottish music version as well, which is floating around there, and throw that out onto social media. And if anybody's interested in seeing that, it's only a minute long, little clip of us in fast motion putting these slates out. It's in the Clacks Wifey podcast playlist on the Indie Live Radio YouTube channel or any of our social media. So hopefully, fingers crossed, that the sun's going to shine tomorrow morning. We're here in Clackmannan, and despite the horrible weather forecast, the rain has held off. It's a bit windy, but it's not too bad. So we're about to do a pop-up Yes Slates exhibition. Let's see how we get on.
This is all right. So,
is this the plan?
Some window dressing.
Oh yeah, I still got my flags from the bridges for Indy stuck on my poles in the back of the car.
Well, maybe on the fence or something, just to. Should we get the? Do you need a hand? I don't think you want it so close to the fence that you can't see it.
We can't film it then either.
Yeah, you're better putting it, I would say, there and.
How many gaffers have
you outnumbered? And you will just, you are merely here as the muscle boy. He knows I'm kidding.
See, there's people curious even now. We're putting up a bit of cardboard. Do you want to say hello for the podcast?
You can film us for a nice time.
Well, I'm going to film it.
It's very professional.
Wow.
We're nothing but professional.
Absolutely.
Anybody thinks we could run our own country?
Yes. You know, it's amazing what you can learn to do just because you have to do it.
I do laugh though at people coming up with, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? You go, we've already thought of that.
I know.
And be careful what you do because the Brit and that is so twisted. Yes, we've thought of that as well.
And there's also lots of, why don't you do X or you do Y? You think, well, why don't you do something?
Yeah, and I think that's what we need to say. We can get this on Yes Stones and go, look, we've done this.
Well, we were up to, there was something like 80-odd shares from Yes Stones and another 30-odd.
I mean, the plan would be, as I say, like, we've done this.
Actually, quite a lot from Yes.
This is, like, what can be done? Why don't then localities like Yes Aberdeen get a wee collective, because there'll be enough artists in the Aberdeenshire area, and that's far easier to coordinate than us who collected them from Dumfries to Oban to Buckey.
Yeah.
We've shown it can be done, but make it easier on yourselves and just
do
your own.
Yeah. But it's much easier for us to post a here's how to do it film, mm-hmm. and here's how to do a stand.
This is what we've done.
Here's how to get a collective going, and people could take it themselves, which would be brilliant.
And then you could have every Yes Hub could have its own slate display.
Yeah.
We call this Operation Moonshot.
No, let's aim higher then. Let's go for Mars.
Sort of sign along the top that would say...
Yes, Lake.
Yes, Lake.
The unicorns and all sorts of...
This is, I think this is my favourite, this little keyhole one.
Oh, that's my one.
I don't know which one's my favourite actually, because each time I see one...
Sometimes the colours just grab your eye. What I found really fun yesterday when we were doing it, Friday, was you look at a thing and you look at it, then suddenly you see something that you didn't notice in it.
Yeah.
You know, a wee detail or a spider or something.
But then I love this, and this was the one when Tina's idea to do this. And when we were gradually sending, right, I've done a D, I've done an S, I've done a whatever, and we were gathering Tina, and she said, I hope it's okay, I'm not sure if my art's good enough. And we're all going, Jesus Christ, who are we supposed to compete with that? Not that it's a competition, but I mean, you see.
Fantastic, isn't it?
Well, we had fun setting all the slates out. Can't say we were swamped with visitors. The weather wasn't great, but there was a lot of cars coming along and obviously very curious to see what we were doing. A couple of passerbys, nobody unpleasant. One person who walked past with his head at a 180 degree angle to make sure he couldn't lay eyes on anything to do with Independence. But apart from that, it was, as much as anything else, it was an experiment in how practical was it to take this show on the road. Then somebody came up with a bright idea of, why don't we take the portable version of the Yes Slates and go up to Clackmannan Tower and take some photos up there with a very recognisable local landmark. So off we trotted, and if we thought it was windy where we started off, oh my goodness, by the time we got to the top of the hill where the Clackmannan Tower is, we could barely stay upright. But we took some photos and I even did a little live stream. So here it is. Hello, this is Fiona from IndieLife Radio. This is the view from the Clackmannan Tower, which we've just climbed a huge windy hill. But we've done that to take photos of the small version of the Yes Slates against Clackmannan Tower, which is 13th century. So here is the Yes Slates banner, which we've been carrying. And this morning we did a pop-up exhibition of the full-size slates, but obviously we couldn't carry them up a huge windy hill. So Clackmannan Tower just goes up and up and up and up. You can see all the way down to the River Forth. You can see the Ochils there. I can see Alloa that way, but from here you can also see the Wallace Monument. Amazing view from all round, and exactly where you'd choose to put a castle if you wanted to know what was going on. And we think it's probably within sight line of Alloa Tower as well, and possibly also Castle Campbell in Dollar that way. And you can also see Stirling Castle, and see Alloa Tower. You can see all these places are in contact. Even in the days before mobile phones, they could signal to each other. This would have been a beacon. And they could keep an eye on what was happening. And when you think Stirling Castle, which, there you go, Stirling Castle's on the horizon. You know, he who holds Stirling holds Scotland. Well, all these towers are part of that defence. So there we go, but it is incredibly windy, and it's quite a long way if you were bringing supplies up here. But we've had an interesting morning with the slates and just practicing live streaming. So we'll catch you later. Bye now. Well, I don't know if we converted any no's to yes this morning, but it certainly blew the cobwebs away, and I was very glad of a big mug of hot soup when I got home. If anybody would like to see the film that we shot of the Yes Slates, it is in the Indie Live Radio YouTube site, and it'll be in the Clacks Women for Indie podcast playlist. You can also get it on the Clacks Women for Indie Facebook page and probably all manner of other places that we've been sharing it to, like Yes Stones. So hopefully you'll be able to see the real thing at some point coming to a location near you. And if anybody has any thoughts on indie-friendly places that you can park close to where you can safely distance and people would like to see a work of art which will become a national treasure once we're independent, then do get in touch and we'd love to hear from you. So that's about it for our adventures this week. Thanks for listening and we'll catch you next time. Bye now.
And then like